welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am Mark Hoffmeyer, and joining me is a man who is part fruit bat, part human. It's John Levengood.
And part Colin Farrell.
How do you become part fruit bat? We're talking about obviously the 1985 Fright Night and the 2011 Fright Night remake, but like, do you go on Ancestry.com? Is there Ancestry.com for vampires?
Well, you know, they didn't have 23andMe back then, or at least, you know, not in 1985. We didn't have a very good grasp on genetics. But you remember, so we had discussed in our last episode, the first part of our Fright Night 1985 and 2011 podcast series here, that Chris Sarandon, the actor who played Jerry the Vampire, it was his idea to come to Tom Holland, the writer and director, with this notion of Jerry always eating fruit. And I think they got it in two or three scenes in the first movie. And the idea was that Chris Sarandon was just researching vampires and bats. And he just realized that most bats on the planet ate fruit. And he liked that maybe that was in his ancestry. And that's kind of a funny notion, isn't it? Like, I feel like that's a really cool idea that doesn't totally fit.
It just raises a lot of questions.
Like,
I love on the fly stuff that makes you go, what? Because so many movies have done that.
But you know, so when I was, before I ever saw the documentary explaining the making of, I honestly looked at it as, because he was eating apples, I looked at it as tooth care.
Oh.
Healthy teeth because he's a vampire. I honestly thought it was that. I never processed the other side of it. And,
you know, there's a trope about jerks eating apples in cinema.
Did you come up with this trope?
No. Type in jerk characters eating apples.
Am I going to find, is the number one Google search an article you wrote?
Nope. But it's,
I feel like I would.
It's already been done, actually. And you have Chris Pine jerkily eating an apple in Star Trek, and many other instances of jerky people eating apples.
Freddy Krueger, Nightmare on Elm Street Part 4.
Yep. Because they make loud noises, they interrupt. Just jerky people eat apples in movies.
They have a tendency to throw it like over their shoulder when it's not done and they litter it.
Yeah. Like, I don't think I've ever seen an apple be thrown away correctly on screen.
It's boy, that's an interesting, no one just has an empty core, a finished core, and they just like place it in a trash can.
I've never seen an apple be placed in a trash can.
If it gets into a trash can, it's because someone like hook-shotted it from 8 feet away, and you're like, that's rude. I don't care. It's impressive that that went in, but that was rude.
It's like Chet, like a jerky guy named, Biff, taking a bite of an apple, throwing it over his shoulder, and hitting it like in a trash can.
Oh my God, our whole last podcast, I kept referring to Bill Paxton from Weird Science, and I kept calling him Biff.
Yeah.
And I should have been saying Chet. Mark, thank you for that erratum.
Like a jerk wasting an apple and hitting it in a trash can. Now, if you live in the woods and you throw a trash can, or if you throw an apple into the woods, you're not wasting it because something will eat it.
You're welcome, woods.
Yeah. So you can, but I've never seen somebody eat an apple alone in the woods in the movies either.
But yeah. So it's like, but if we were, to take away the sacrilegious origins that created the monster that is Dracula, if we were to put that aside and instead come up with some zany genealogical explanation for vampires, it doesn't make sense for a fruit bat to be anywhere in there. And not that most people know this, but fruit bats like aren't even in the same family. Like dogs are in a family, cats are in a family. Bats are actually a whole lot of families. So fruit bats are no more related to vampire bats than dogs are to cats.
So you're making this sound like the mafia. There's a bunch of families.
Oh, it is like this. The warring families of fruit bats, most of them small and adorable.
Oh my gosh. I want to see some small and adorable vampires.
It's like this homogenized notion of bats that I guess gave Chris Sarandon the idea of this. And you know what's interesting is that we're talking about jerky apple eating, and I feel like the jerkiness of the apple eating fits better into the 2011 remake than it does the original.
Oh, because he jerkily eats apples.
Yep.
To prove points, he goes back to get an apple, knowing that people are hiding in his home, just to mess with him while mm-hmm. eating an apple.
He's like, I know people are in my home, and I kind of want an apple. I'm going to use that apple to distress them.
Yeah, jerky apple eating.
Let's go back to the poor decision making of vampire. Well, we'll get into it later. We're gonna get into it.
I have to say, the vampires in these two Fright Night movies make poor decisions. But I love both of them nonetheless. So, in the words of John Lazareth, I think it's time for a listener question.
So, yes, and before we even introduce the film, this remake does star Anton Yelchin. Is that how you say his name?
Yelchin.
Anton Yelchin as our Charlie Brewster protagonist. And Johnny Numb, big friend of the pod, repeat question contributor, and self-proclaimed convoluted listener question submitter, gives us a 283-word question. I did a word count.
I love it.
So, Johnny Numb asks, Anton Yelchin starred in the remake of Fright Night and brought his usual infectious everyman or every young man personality to the proceedings. I quite enjoyed his take on Charlie Brewster, and I found the film overall to be very strong. Almost as strong as Tom Holland's excellent 1985 original. In 2016, Yelchin starred in Green Room, one of my favorite films of the new millennium. It goes without saying that his presence is dearly missed. Whether in big-budgeted fare like Abrams' Star Trek films or smaller art house efforts. But my question is one of hypothetical cinematic universe crossover. Green Room has many genre parallels, from early works of John Carpenter to Carpenter disciple Robert Rodriguez's vampire siege tale From Dusk Till Dawn. In some parallel world, which would you like to see? A version of Green Room, where Nazis are swapped out with vampires, or a version of From Dusk Till Dawn, where the titty twister is invaded by a horde of Nazis. To extend this question further, if the Gecko brothers were integrated into this world of Green Room with vampires, how would the Ain't Rights appraise them? Would they band together in a shared fight for survival with the Gecko brothers, or would they reject Seth and Richie for their sadistic lives of crime, setting into motion a battle royale between three disparate factions? Good Lord, Johnny Numb, you have reached deeper into the abyss than I could have ever imagined.
So I either want a movie where two vampires are stuck in a room being attacked by Nazis, or
two vampires,
or like a band of vampires.
Okay.
Like a prog rock vampire band are stuck and are being attacked by Nazis.
Is prog rock a popular music genre for vampires?
Well, if you watch Queen of the Damned and Only Lovers Left Alive, they're very kind of stylized like that. So, and if you watch Blade 2, there's that like kind of new metal-esque band of vamp, like music.
Please write an article about prog rock vampires. Please do that.
All right. So I would love to see that, or I'd love to see the From Dusk Till Dawn already in motion with the Gecko brothers being attacked by vampires, but out of nowhere Nazis come. So you're like, who am I rooting for? The Nazis? Am I rooting for the vampires? Do the vampires team up with the Gecko brothers because they just hate the Nazis?
Well, I almost view this as one of those things where the Nazis are fighting the Gecko brothers, maybe over some heist or loot or disagreement, right? But then they will begrudgingly realize their greater foe. Well, and maybe their fight goes on for a while the vampires are picking them off and they don't even know it. They think, like, what if Richie died horribly in a blood explosive attack to the neck and Seth comes in and thinks the Nazis did it?
Yeah.
And so, like, it might take until minute 45 of this movie for there even to be an inkling that there's something else doing this.
I just love the idea of the vampires attacking them. Then all of a sudden the Nazis come out of nowhere with tanks and panzers and they just blitzkrieg speaking German and everyone just gets confused.
So were the Gecko brothers raiding the neo-Nazi lair because they recently stole some Hasidic Jews' diamonds?
So they stole.
Do they want to steal the diamonds that the Nazis stole from Jewish people, like a Jewish diamond business in New York City.
I feel like they're hiding out. Wait, okay. Are vampires part of this?
Eventually.
So the vampires are going to attack while they're in a neo-Nazi music club?
Yes.
Jeez Louise, this is
I'm actually just more focused at the moment on how did the Gecko brothers collide with the Nazis in the first place.
I mean, seems right. They're all dirt bags.
But I mean, what brought their paths to cross?
Probably time travel.
Now we're really getting into it.
I'm thinking they get sucked into an ancient Incan time thing, get shot back to World War II, and have to help vampires fight the Nazis.
Oh, you're going with 1942 Nazis.
Yeah.
Because now confession, I haven't seen Green Room. It's not because I don't want to see Green Room, listeners. I just haven't yet. And Mark has sung great praises of it.
I picture them more as skinheads.
Weren't they neo-Nazis in Green Room?
Yeah, but they're more. I just picture them more. They're more just like a bunch of impressionable skinheads being led by a guy, you know, for a drug operation.
Oh, so Patrick Stewart isn't really a contemporary neo-Nazi?
I mean, yeah, he is. But I just think I just have a funnier vision in my head because I've been watching Archer.
Boy, now I'm thinking of Indiana Jones movies.
Yeah.
And picturing that setting. Okay, with the Gecko brothers, time travel. This just became my science project. Meets From Dusk Till Dawn. Meets Green Room.
I love it. And I do think the Gecko brothers would team up with the Ain't Rights because the Gecko brothers teamed up with Harvey Keitel and all of them. And I could see, even though they all hate each other, they realize that they're being cornered by a bunch of, you know, neo-Nazi drug dealers who want to kill them in Portland or in Oregon.
Well, and if we're matching the exact characters, our George Clooney is pragmatic and our Patrick Stewart is probably very methodical. So it's just what makes sense for the humans to survive until afterwards where we humans can decide to kill each other again.
Oh, I was thinking about the Gecko brothers and the Ain't Rights fighting the neo-Nazis in the club in Green Room.
Oh, you see, so I haven't seen the movie. I just assumed that the Ain't Rights were skinheads.
No.
Were the Ain't Rights Anton Yelchin's group?
Oh, so what happens is they're a hardcore band, punk band. They're from I believe out east, but they're way out west. And they have a show that turns out to be a flop, so they need some money to get home because they have to siphon gas and everything. And this guy who feels bad that he set him up for the show gets him a gig at this neo-Nazi place. And they play their show. They actually start off with a song called Nazi Punks, Fuck Off, which is pretty cool. And, they antagonize the neo-Nazis in the club. But as they're packing out, everything's going fine. They got their money. They're going to go back home. They walk into a room and they see a woman stabbed in the eye. And then from there, it just escalates into a very realistic, very bloody, very fast, ugly violence.
Sounds like my speed of movie.
Yeah. I mean, they're a punk band. So they just went to this to get money so they could get home.
So they don't have to siphon gas. Poor guys.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. But during their journeys, they could easily have run across the Gecko brothers.
Man, what a weird question. I want to.
You know what's funny?
I want to know. Was peyote involved in coming up with this question? I'm sorry, Mark. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I immediately went back to I guess they happened before that in the late 30s, but I just went to like the classic stock Nazis and with time travel. That's why I think it'd be funny just in a 1990s movie, a bunch of 1940s Nazis attack a vampire club in Mexico. It'd be chaos.
Convoluted question indeed, Johnny Numb.
Well, you know those movies. You know those movies like where that Tarantino sort of specialized. Oh, good, the bad, and the ugly, I guess. But they kind of the good guys end up hurting the vampires into fighting the Nazis. They kind of, you know, one's going down one street, the other's going down another street, and they come across each other, and that's how they escape by starting a Nazi vampire battle.
You just reminded me of the alley battle in Big Trouble with Little China when Kurt Russell and Egg Chen were running away from the three storms, and then they came across those two warring clans.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I'm picturing in my head. I like it. And everyone should watch Green Room. Green Room is, it was one of my favorite films of 2016. Jeremy Saulnier is a great director. If you want to hear a good commentary, I bought the Blu-ray just to listen to the commentary. Very good commentary. And it features Anton Yelchin and Imogen Poots, who are both in 2011's Fright Night. I crushed that. I want an associate producer for Green Room right now.
I mean, absolutely. Gosh, John.
You're throwing for a loop right now.
By the way, you listeners, listen to Mark. You should absolutely watch Green Room. I haven't even seen it. But everyone who I trust says that. But you should also see, if you haven't yet, for this episode of the podcast, 2011 Fright Night, you should probably also see From Dusk Till Dawn. And you should probably also see J.J. Abrams' Star Trek.
And I would have to recommend Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
And Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
All three Indiana Jones films.
Yeah, just the three of them.
There are only three.
Yeah, and Saving Private Ryan.
That's more of a fourth film than whatever anyone else said was.
And you should watch Tigerland because Colin Farrell's in it. And you should watch SWAT because it stars Samuel L. Jackson.
And Colin Farrell.
And Colin Farrell. What do you think?
Done.
I'm on fire. Let's do it, John.
So today we're going to talk about the 2011 remake of Fright Night. Now, I'm just going to come out and say it. When this first came out and I first saw it, I was bothered by it. I was a 1985 purist, and I've since put down my angry fandom hat. I watched it again on Mark's suggestion years ago, liked it more. We said we were planning this podcast a year ago, watched it again, liked it more. We finally got around to doing this podcast now, so I watched it again last week. And much as I said last episode about the original 1985 Fright Night, which I've probably seen a dozen times, I like it more every single time I see it. Maybe this is me maturing a little bit. Maybe this is me appreciating its differences and what it's trying to do. But I went from someone who saw it once and was like, ugh, to seeing it and really enjoying it. And I bought it. I own this now on purpose. So interesting thing. Mark, would you like to introduce this film with the synopsis?
Well, actually, when I first saw this, I saw this movie in a drive-in with my wife, Megan, and we just had a great time watching it. And I hadn't actually watched the original Fright Night yet. And I just love this movie. I thought the acting was good. I mean, you have Toni Collette, you have Anton Yelchin, you have Imogen Poots, Colin Farrell, David Tennant, who's fantastic. You have, who's the kid from us? You have McLovin in it.
McLovin!
Dave Franco. Just a very good cast, directed by Craig Gillespie, who made a ton of noise by directing I, Tonya recently. So, really talented look of it. I love the idea of it. But it was almost a perfect drive-in movie. I really loved it. I almost think I saw that with a doubleheader with Final Destination 5. And
which I adore too. Wait, but before you get into more about this movie, can you explain what you mean by a perfect drive-in movie?
It's just,
because I've never been to a drive-in, by the way. It's funny that you saw the 2011 Fright Night the way that a lot of 1985 Fright Night people saw the first one.
Yeah, it's funny. It's light. It's breezy. It has good dialogue, good performances. It moves very fast. You know, you can't watch Kramer versus Kramer or Dr. Zhivago at a drive-in. You gotta, you know, it's good to watch a 90-minute, breezy, fun, chill. You have your beers in the cooler in the back, eating your popcorn, getting some King of Pops in Atlanta, eating a lot, chilling, just watching a fun, relaxing movie that doesn't involve too much thought. When I think of drive-in movies, I think of Joe Johnston, the guy who directed Captain America First Avenger. He also did Jumanji. He did The Rocketeer. For me, these are kind of movies you just want to see on a big screen outside surrounded by other cars. And I love this movie. I also bought it. I've been actually singing its praises for a very long time. And do I think it's, here's why I like it. Same plot. Kid named Charlie has a neighbor moved in. He thinks he's a vampire. Turns out he is a vampire. He enlists the help of a guy named Peter Vincent, and together they battle this vampire. For me, I thought it was told well. I thought they used the Las Vegas scenery really well. And so I guess that's what I'm getting at for this movie. And I also like that I don't like most horror remakes. And if you go on Movies, Films, and Flicks, I've written about every single horror remake. I wrote about every single 21st century remake. And the one thing I don't like about the one major flaw of bad remakes for me are like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre or other ones where they're just, there's nothing new about them. There's nothing different. They're basically just glossier retreads. And I feel like this Fright Night did enough to justify its existence by being different to make it worthwhile. And I didn't know that the first time I watched it.
Interesting. And just to add to that, you didn't like the remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
I fell asleep.
I loved it.
In the theater.
I love it.
I watched it and I fell asleep.
I think it is an inferior film, but a superior movie.
Maybe
that makes more sense. But.
I respect your opinions always. And
you're holding back.
Because we're talking about movies. There's no right or wrong here because it's opinion. I actually think the first one's a great film.
Oh no, it is. That's a fact. You are right. It is.
Oh, you're saying the remake's a better flick?
Yes.
Got it.
Remember how you've said this on the podcast like probably 10 times, how when you first saw it, you remember it being this brutal, gory flick, and it's not. The original, it was not a gory film, but you remembered that. And so, but now for contemporary audiences, they made it the brutal, like that. What was it? Alexandre Ajat who did, he did Piranha 3D, but the person who did the remake of a French guy who did the remake of The Hills Have Eyes also brutalized it. Just, you know, with the hostile wave and the Saw wave. But that's what I liked about it. I like brutal movies. And so that's what made it work for me.
Got it. It felt vanilla to me, the new Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Any notion of character reveals, I'm going to agree.
I fell asleep during a movie called The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
I'm sorry, but I've totally distracted you. You really loved and appreciated this film, and you saw it before the original.
Yeah, and I think now that I know if you listen to our podcast from last week, I know a lot more about the audience of the original Fright Night. They revere that movie, the 1985 film. They love it. And I don't think this movie does it any disservice. And you could keep these two separate. Some guy said that like it wrecked everything about Fright Night, but they're so different. You can almost look at them as two different films that complement each other. And so one of the smartest things is they moved it out from the suburbs or the backlots of California on studios to Las Vegas. And I kind of love the idea of the transient population, the random suburbs. You know, this is also 2011, so who knows where the housing market was at. There was a lot of empty homes. So blacking in your windows makes sense upon first thought. And there's just so many people who vacation and come in. It makes sense for a vampire to move in there. And I haven't thought about it too much, but just the whole setup and the way they changed it made a lot of, and the changing of the character of Peter Vincent, I thought was really smart to be a Las Vegas entertainer. I loved what they did with the mom, with Toni Collette. I thought she was great. Imogen Poots could have chemistry with a brick. If she was in Castaway and she was with that volleyball, you would like want them to get married because she has such great chemistry with like everything. So, I don't know. I thought it did enough to really earn its existence.
I don't know about that volleyball. I just remember a dude named Wilson.
Yeah. Yeah, Wilson. Yeah. If it was her and Wilson, when Wilson floats away, you wouldn't, you know, you kind of cried a little bit in Castaway. You'd be sobbing. You're like, don't leave Imogen.
Spoiler for that 1999 movie.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, go ahead.
I agree with you. And it's interesting. So, everyone in the country who would listen to this podcast probably understands the nature of casinos in Las Vegas and nightlife. But for real, if by chance you have not been to Vegas, there is like no other city where it totally makes sense, where when you are out in the city of Henderson, which is actually where most of the Vegas employees live, which is Vegas adjacent, to actually have newspapers or something totally blotting out Windows. So much of the industry, of the employment industry there, is geared around this entertainment that it's not just a small cross-section of people. To call it perfect, as you said, Mark, for a vampire to slip into Vegas, I mean, on point.
It's just a smart decision. And I like the idea of Peter Vincent being like a, what, Christopher Angel? No, wait, David Angel?
Yeah, no, yeah. It is a Chris Angel clone with the vampire killer performance spin, but they're still doing the levitations and all this stuff and the fire and the hoses on stage. And that, yeah, that was a nice touch. It's funny. This is the touch that, like, upset me when I first saw the movie. And now I'm like, this is lovely. Again, it's like I feel like I was replaced with another person watching this movie later, but I remember the feelings and echoes of the person whose body I took.
And you know what's kind of crazy? I'm a big Doctor Who fan now, but I didn't start watching Doctor Who till like a few years ago. But if I'd have watched this film when I was a big Whovian and known that the 10th Doctor, David Tennant, was in it, I would have loved it even more. Like, this movie, I don't know how they got this cast to begin with.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, because Yelchin was getting popular. I can't imagine he was cheap. Colin Farrell obviously isn't cheap. Now, David Tennant, I don't know where he really was, quote-wise. And Imogen would have been inexpensive. Toni Collette, I don't know where she falls.
I mean, she's been crushing movies since the 90s with About a Boy and everything.
But I don't think she was a high price tag.
But maybe they just got really good bang for their buck in this movie. And you know, Doctor Who was popular, but it didn't quite break until the 11th Doctor. So, you know, maybe David Tennant was trying to, like, break in here in the United States at that time. Matt Smith was the 11th Doctor. But I don't know. I love the original Fright Night, but I don't think there are any performances that are as iconic as Evil Ed. Or anything like that, but I think the performances are just all solid all around.
I feel like, yeah, these characters didn't have that – they didn't hit home as well for me, but I feel like they had more moments, if you know what I mean.
What do you think about the changing of Charlie? So in the original, we just had Charlie never interacted with any other high schooler kids, had a girlfriend for a year, didn't really have many confidence issues. Like, he just was like a normal kid that we didn't get into at all. But in this one, you have Anton, who was kind of a dorky kid, like a former, like, who actually would be cool now. But he kind of, like, stops hanging out with his buddies. Evil Ed, because he starts dating Amy, who's actually really cool. And, of course, she would have put up with all of his Star Wars antics. But he kind of, like, starts hanging out with the dorky, or the jerky cool kids who make fun of his mochaccinos and shoes. I was kind of annoyed by that. I'm like, oh man, like, why are they making him a bad guy? But
that was, it was trope service.
Yeah. But yeah. And I was talking to Meg, my wife, and she's like, you know, kids like this probably do this in high school. It is a cliche, but I mean, it's not that far off. And I'm like, yeah, I guess it is a trope.
It's not far off, but it's not necessary.
Yeah.
Because in 1985, it was a clear trope. I think that, despite all the cyberbullying and all the stuff that happens now, bullying in the 80s was horrible and rampant, and cliques and everything was horrible and rampant then too. I think that film just chose not to make a thing of it, and this film chose to acknowledge its presence.
And I guess that totally wasn't necessary in this movie. I don't know.
It's okay.
Yeah, but it's not annoying at all. I guess they had to find something. And it actually makes this version of Evil Ed a little bit more tragic. Because Evil Ed is the one who knew that Jerry was a vampire. He had footage of him. Should we get into the movie here?
I'm going to agree with you here that as we're introduced to the characters, Ed is the, well, Ed and the mother are the two characters that are richer in this remake. And I think that the other characters, or not Peter Vincent, but our Charlie and Amy are a little cheaper.
You know what I did like a lot in this movie? And we're jumping all over the place, but whatever. I love the scene where Colin Farrell's like, hey, let me in. And the mom's like, no, because she listens to her son. You know, in a lot of movies, they'd be like, oh, you're crazy. Yeah, come on in. But in this one, she's like, uh-uh. And then he blows up their house. But I kind of like that scene where the mom gets Charlie's back. I thought that was pretty neat.
Yeah, so I'm gonna reel us back. Can I reel us back?
Yeah, let's do it. We're jumping.
I'm gonna snag you with this fish hook. I'm gonna line you back like I'm king fishing in the Gulf of Mexico here. And I want to bring back. So we were introduced to the characters, and our Charlie is now this used to be uncool. Now he's trying to play cool, like Love Don't Cost a Thing, Patrick Dempsey movies. And his girlfriend's very cool. Ed and he, so Ed in this movie seems to be kind of like a mishmash of evil Ed and Charlie in the first movie. Cause like you said, Ed is the one who discovers everything. Ed is the one who isn't believed at first, right? And Ed is the one who's more the just the geek out of the two. And Charlie has tried to leave that. I like that flavor. And they are going to go investigate before we even meet our Jerry or really get to know our mom.
Yeah.
They're going to go investigate because instead of dead prostitutes, like in the first movie, a student has disappeared, and it is an old friend of Charlie and Ed's.
And what's interesting is Charlie shows up late to join Ed, and that leads to Ed's demise.
Yeah, it contributes to it, yeah. And it's like Charlie was just angstily dealing with his mother and his girlfriend, and this wasn't a priority.
Actually, what'd you think about the intro of the vampire killing the family in Fright in this movie?
So the opening scene?
Yeah.
So that, it's fine. I feel like that's just the typical way to open a lot of horror movies is with a kill.
Yeah.
Because you know you're going to lead into exposition.
I like that established when Ed said that this vampire is like the shark from Jaws. I thought that was pretty cool. I just like Jaws references.
And Ed was saying that because of the shark mouth of Amy in part one.
Did he really? Is that a fact?
Well, they even call it a shark mouth.
Really?
In the first, in Tom Holland called Amy's mouth a shark mouth. He told the effects guy he wanted a shark mouth.
So you think the writer of this movie had them throw in Jaws?
Yes.
Fact?
Well, I don't know it's a fact, but that's what I think is fact.
Well, I just kind of like that he said this is a mean vampire. This vampire is not, like, he does play some games, but he wants to kill people.
He's the shark from Jaws. But, yeah. I honestly think that was influenced by the documentaries about Fright Night.
Interesting. I just like Jaws references.
And before there was ever the You're So Cool, Brewster documentary, there was the longer cut that I have on Blu-ray. Oh, a Blu-ray release. But it actually predates You're So Cool, Brewster, which, I don't know, I think came out several years ago. But that's my suspicion. I thought that it was based on that. I thought that was just a nice callback to the origins of that effect. But regardless of what it was, the statement resonates.
It sets a good tone. I like that, like my love of, I just like nasty vampires.
You know what else it does? That's a 1975 movie. That is a very enlightened 2011 teenager to be referring to a 1975 movie. Well, he knows his horror movies.
That's right. So 2011. Yeah. I mean, so he basically is the Charlie Ed of this movie.
Yeah. That was my take on it anyway. Again, it felt like a merging of them.
Got it. Now, I thought Christopher Mintz-Plasse was good in this role. I felt for him, and I kind of hate that the way he went down in that pool. Like, I thought he was a pretty relatable character.
Yeah, it's so funny that he went down in a pool after he called Jerry the shark from Jaws.
Isn't that awesome?
And then, of course, we start to see the effect, but we don't see the full effect that the later in the movie will show us, that Jerry kind of has a little head twitch before his turn, almost like the lichens in Underworld. Or even an American Werewolf in Paris, I should say, not London. But they have that little twitch before they start to turn. And then his mouth got a little bigger. His head got tiny, but then he bit the hell out.
Yeah, and then blood all up in the pool. But it was a little Lost Boys, too, that he had been filming this thing. And Jerry was invisible.
So I want to reflect on 1985. Because in 1985, we kept pointing out these little loose fallacies and presentation of situational awareness, as you put it before. And in this, Charlie doesn't believe Ed, and Ed says, "You don't understand, I have visual evidence." Ed does not explain that he has videos of an invisible man walking around.
Yeah, there's twice in this movie where Ed should have shown the footage. Why are clothes invisible in vampires?
It goes with their mystique.
Because Dracula Den Lovin' It didn't do that. And then there's another time where Charlie goes to Peter Vincent and starts asking him about vampires, but he should have just shown him those pictures he took right off the bat.
Right. And they did the same thing in 1985 Fright Night. The reflection, even when Charlie was attacked in his bedroom, you don't see the reflection when he walks by Charlie's mirror on his chaise lounge.
Interesting.
So just that's senseless, but I think it's meant to go, by the way. My real understanding of the presentation is that it's meant to go that they have no reflection because they're soulless. It's an affront to religion, and it the fact that they're wearing clothes is erroneous. That individual is sacrilege, and they do not cast a reflection. And so I think that's the real reason. But, or I'm sorry, the justified reason. But I think that the real reason is that filmmakers just find it more convenient.
Or their clothes represent a sacrilegious type of consumerism that has consumed all.
Well, what if vampires only wear the clothes that they died in? Just like Kirsten Dunst in Interview with a Vampire, she couldn't cut her hair. It grew back to how she died.
So she's like the Santa Claus? Of vampires.
She's like the Tim Allen Santa Claus, the Kirsten Dunst hairdressing victim, slash the clothes of any vampire in a reflection.
That'd be terrible. If I'd have got it when I was like in my jorts phase, I'd have been the nerdiest vampire on the planet.
So when we meet Jerry, and I don't mean when we meet him when he kills Ed, but when Charlie meets Jerry, what'd you think of our Jerry? Now you saw this first. But now that you've seen the original 85 Jerry, how do you reflect on meeting Colin Farrell's Jerry?
Are we talking about the scene where he's asking for beer?
Oh, no. I mean, it was the gardening. When Charlie came home and he was helping, like, with gardening or with a pipe or something, it was before that.
Oh, when Toni Collette was talking to him, his mom.
Yes.
When Jane was talking to him.
And he was saying, oh, yeah, I'll get that dumpster out of there. And then he does, in fact, get that dumpster out of there because he just moved in.
I think it's very unassuming. He probably knew the neighbors had to see him eventually. And he kind of knows, he's probably really old, so he knows how to kind of woo people like that. He knows how to be normal.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was a good introduction. He seemed as less inconspicuous than Jerry did. Than Jerry from the original Fright Night did.
I felt that his charm when we first met him was purely, I don't want to just use the word sexual, but sociosexual.
Oh, of course he went for that. I've been reading a lot of, I like to read about the movies before we do it. And I've been reading a lot of reviews where everyone's talking about Colin Farrell doing that.
Yeah, as opposed to being more charming and graceful.
Yeah.
But that, I guess that goes with the times, right? In the 80s, if you were not that we call them gentlemen callers in the 80s, but in the 80s, if you were the guy coming over for a date, I still remember even being a kid. If your mom's dating someone, the introductions are very different and much less casual than they are, say, in 2011 versus 1985. So maybe that was just a contemporization. But of course, it stuck out to me very starkly, just as such a devout lover of the first film. It seems so different. But really, I guess it fits the time quite appropriately.
Yeah, no, I think it was a good introduction. So when you first see the house with Jerry and Billy, you're kind of like, what is going on? Like, you know, Jerry is kind of a bit off. I think this guy would blend in pretty well. Like, oh, I just do night construction on the strip. And I liked how he called out the shoes that Charlie was wearing. Oh, those are puce. He's like, oh, you play ball? Like, very unassuming, I thought.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think he wanted to be bothered, this Jerry.
Well, much like original Jerry.
Yeah, but Jerry did a lot more to being bothered than this Jerry did.
How so?
Standing by windows with you know, prostitutes, and then biting her neck in front of an open window, carrying coffins around at night, having constant noises coming from the house, having people disappear, flying around, popping up into rooms, showing as a vampire. I just think he was a lot more conspicuous than Colin Farrell.
Fair.
Colin Farrell did not want... for some reason, I feel like Jerry didn't care. He was too cocky. He was maybe just too... His hubris got the best of him. But this Jerry, Colin Farrell, I just don't think he wanted any of that.
Fair. I agree. I doubted you, and you have sold me.
All right, cool. Because, you know, he's saying, puce, let's play ball. I work construction. I work night construction on the strip because, you know, I live in Atlanta. There's a lot of night construction on the roads. So let's, you know, there's a lot, probably a lot of, you know.
He's looking for a pickup game. He would crush Anton.
Yeah, he would pull like Halle Berry Catwoman-esque moves with his vampire skills.
So Charlie comes to believe, right? But he eventually sees Evil Ed's footage, like we were discussing with the clothes don't show. Eventually, we come to find that there's a go-go dancer living across the street. I think that was the contemporary Vegas equivalent of 1985's prostitute.
And they make some jokes about that.
Right. And that was, but whatever. She seemed to be a very sincere character. And I'm going to say again, this is another movie where I like basically all the characters. The weakest one might have been Dave Franco for me, but I still liked him in it anyway. And but so that comes along. And but we met the mom. When we first met Jerry with Charlie, we met mom. And mom was Toni Collette. And in this movie, mom plays an active role. And in the first movie, mom was a very pleasant character, but was a passive role.
Yeah.
And I actually thought that helped. Not helped. It was just different. But I liked the way that worked. I liked that the mother was a part of the doubting crowd with Amy and then became a part of the protagonist crowd eventually and was, you know, and wasn't the unwary, stupid parent.
And she's a real estate agent who has stakes at her house. Which they show early on. And you know what? One aspect I liked about this movie, I won't talk about the end, but anytime that Anton Yelchin is, he'll always tell, like, Imogen Poots or Toni Collette, hey, stay away, run away. They always save him. So there's a scene later on where he's like, ladies, you know, like, mom, get away. Then the mom jumps in and stakes Jerry. There's another scene where he tells Amy to go away and she's like, holy water, vampire, and douses him in the face and then saves him by hitting Evil Ed in the face with a giant mace. So it's kind of neat how they flip that where, no, I got this, you know, run. And then they save him.
Right. Cause he's always too close to the danger. He's always too preoccupied.
I don't know. I kind of like that he's always telling them to run, but then they save him. It's a good subtle flip on all that.
And it also gave a good, I feel like whenever this is brought up, someone listening is going to get bothered somehow, but it's the anti-damseling. It was a very credible equal empowerment scenario.
But I think it's time, you know, and I like how it all felt natural. Like they were strong characters protecting their son and boyfriend.
And no one did anything unrealistic.
Yeah. It was cool.
Man or woman.
Yeah. I dug how they did that. And you know what? One scene I loved is they even did it, I forgot her name, the dancer that Jerry brings into her house.
Doris.
So Doris goes into the house for a date with Jerry. Actually, Jerry goes to talk with Charlie beforehand and asks for beer.
That's critical.
Yeah. And Charlie is like, hands him beer, but he does it outside of the house, which I thought was pretty cool. And then Jerry knows immediately. That's a
right,
good
and that's that thing. It's like you're doing this test, but when you're doing the test, you're letting the testee know that he's being tested. And that was it was very telling to the audience.
Yeah, it's a good, good scene, way they set that up. And what I liked most is you hear a scream. I don't know why. Well, let's see. Colin Farrell leaves his house and Anton Yelchin goes into the vampire lair and you find upstairs that there's this room with all his victims that he keeps in there and he just drains them occasionally.
Dude, it is a turning facility.
Yeah.
That room was actually in my head likened to movies with sex trafficking, where you have this hidden compartment, and then there's this hallway with that kind of office lighting, and there were all these little rooms, and that was just so. That was a turning facility, though.
Yeah, because he wanted to raise his own crew,
which already totally took us out of the realm of the original, where, granted, he turned one person and he had his kind of servant, but in this, he's got an operation set up.
Yeah, he's an operation. He's turning them.
He's got an operation.
And I guess what I like the most is he comes back home. Jerry has to hide in one of the rooms, and
Charlie, Jerry.
So Charlie's hiding. Anton Yelchin's hiding. Jerry comes in, finds Doris, and starts sucking her blood. And I thought that was really cool. Doris lifted up her finger to tell Charlie to be quiet. Like, that was a nice touch. Like, that.
She knew she was done for, and she was a nice neighbor. She was a nice person. She just wanted to spare him.
It's like I know it's a remake of a 1985 horror film, but that scene had a thought to it, and it made
there was,
me like.
But the there was nothing like that in the first one, though. Yeah. Like, that was a good, unique scene.
Set up some good things, and then Farrell, as he's leaving that crazy dungeon room, kind of smells Charlie. And Charlie ends up getting Doris, and they walk downstairs, and that's what we talked about earlier, where Farrell starts messing with him with the Budweiser and the apple, and he knows he's in there, and he lets her run outside so she can get killed by the sunlight.
And so that Charlie can suffer that realization.
Yeah, like, that's mean. Like, he's a mean vampire.
Because, I mean, he wanted to turn her.
Yeah.
But he chose instead to, and he knew from the beer exchange, he knew that Charlie knew that he was a vampire, and he knew that Charlie was in the house, and he wanted to turn Doris into a vampire, but he chose to let Charlie take her outside so that Charlie could suffer the realization of what he did.
And
that is mean.
And he's not going to offer Charlie any, there's going to be no, like, hey, if you just forget about me, I'll forget about you. No. There's none of that.
Because this is a mean vampire.
And Charlie basically sealed his fate. This vampire is going to kill him.
Jerry was not mean in 1985. In this, I feel like Colin Farrell is playing a combination of Jerry and Billy. He is charming in his own way, but he is also now the machinating bully.
He does become a bully, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. He takes pleasure in it. He watches as Charlie realizes it with a little grin. So I was very disappointed, especially when I first saw this, that there was no Billy Cole, that there was no caretaker or servant or vampire spawn or interim. And now, like, I later come to realize that this Jerry is both characters from 1985. And it's just different. And that's interesting. It's so funny how I was so bothered by that when I first saw it. Now I appreciate it.
And I almost don't see this Jerry wanting attention or wanting people to hang out with him. He seems very much so like a lone wolf. I don't even know if he would have hung out with these people that he's turning. Maybe he would send them out somewhere else. Like, I don't even know. It's interesting. I don't see him hanging out with people.
Well, we will get into the fact that I think it's very obvious that he doesn't care.
Yeah.
Based on his other spawn.
His other spawn.
His other, like, 50 spawn.
Oh, yeah. All right. Do you want to take a quick break, and then we'll get back to the rest of this movie?
Absolutely.
All right. Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I love this movie, John.
I'm hesitant to use the word love, but I'm a big fan. It's a lot of fun, and I think it's highly rewatchable. So I'm with you. We have different passions, and it might be hedged in the order in which we saw these movies.
Now, I don't think my love comes from it being a great film. I just think it's a good background movie that I enjoy putting on.
That's fair. I I guess in the movies, films, and flick spirit, I'm going to call Fright Night 1985 somewhere between a movie and a film for me. I'm going to call this somewhere closer to a movie, but between a movie and a flick for me.
Yeah, I think this one's a movie, and I think the original Fright Night's all three. Because there's very heartfelt performances, it has a very movie plot, and it has very flicks elements.
It has some occasional writing short sights.
But I love that though, right? It's all three.
Some head scratching nature. So speaking of head scratching nature, eventually Charlie's got to recruit Peter Vincent.
Oh yeah.
And
I love it.
This Chris Angel vampire slayer.
David Tennant in leather pants that he's chafing and getting rashes.
And he's a prima donna when things don't go well during his rehearsals. And Charlie sneaks in, falsifying himself as some member of the press to interview him. And he's whining at these, you know, busty, scantily clad women on the stage. It turns out one of them is his live-in girlfriend or wife, I suppose.
She's my favorite. She's sassy.
Is it? Okay. Now, do you think that they were trying to go for a Salma Hayek Dust Till Dawn with her?
I don't think so. She seemed to have her own performance going on. Because Salma Hayek, Dust Till Dawn, she never speaks. This one's like very... This one's been with him for a long time, knows his crap.
Knows his bullshit?
Yeah, exactly. Just isn't afraid to... And he loves it, by the way. He's like... He loves her. And...
That was such an interesting interplay. Those two just suddenly going at each other with all that zeal.
And I love the way she drops the exposition as she's walking Charlie through his... She's like, now, you know, experts call him about vampire stuff.
Right, and his place is basically like a vampire museum of these collectibles because he's rich and he's got all this stuff. He's got all these rare papers. Started out with a few silly things.
He spent millions of dollars, I would say.
So it seems, yeah. He is quite well settled, by the way. He must have a 20-year contract with the Hard Rock Cafe to have that 20,000-square-foot suite.
Yeah.
Because that museum hall is gigantic.
When they do residencies, it's just for about a year. He must have a serious residency going on.
Liberace didn't have that much space.
Yeah, he's like the new he's like the Barry Manilow of magicians on Vegas. Yeah,
That was cool, and it's so fun when we see him, like, you know, take off his wig and take off his fake facial hair. He gets out of his clothes. Not to mock anyone who likes this liquor, but I thought it was funny that instead of some old wine or some fine old whiskey, he looks at his woman and he says, "Midori me." Like he's drinking this... You know, this kind of fruity standard liquor, you know, that he just likes it. And that's fine. You know, he's such a quirky guy. He's sitting around scratching and adjusting himself in his tight, uncomfortable leather pants. And it actually reminded me a lot of the movie Rockstar, between taking off the wig, you know, and just like hating the leather pants.
And I thought it was a neat touch too, where He was talking to Charlie. He's like, "Oh, I'm going to pop your reporting cherry." Like, he was nice about it. He's like, "This is going to be fun. I'm going to have, like, a first-time reporter."
Yeah, he was a little flattered, even though he'd clearly been through the motions a lot.
Yeah, it was kind of a cool scene. And once again, Charlie should have started with those pictures he took inside of Jerry's home of, like, what does he worship, actually? We never talked about. What does Jerry worship? Like, what are these?
That's right. So you mean how it's revealed that Jerry is a particular species of vampire later in the film. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, what kind of species was he?
They just said an ancient species, this, that, and the other, that does a slow kill, and this, that, and the other, and tries to amass hordes. It was very, you know, hand-wavy, generalized. But what they were really revealing, I guess, to us is that there are different kinds or species, if you will, of vampire. And Jerry is this one, based on this symbol that Charlie brought to Jerry.
See, I think that's cool.
It's a nice flavor. It's a nice flavor. It's interesting. It's and Jerry, just like in the old movie, the original movie, the first time Jerry doesn't believe shit. The second time he shows up, the shit actually hits the fan a little sooner in their relationship because Evil Ed shows up.
Yep. Wait, do you get deliveries at 1 a.m.?
That's right. It's like, oh, you just invited him in. I get that that's like a clever contemporization of inviting someone in, but I don't feel that telling your doorman to send someone up is an invitation in the sense of violation of space for a vampire.
Yeah, that's cheating a little bit.
But it's okay. I knew it was happening. I wasn't upset by it. It just like okay, vampire's coming up. And that was a fun encounter.
Oh yeah. Wait, do you want to get back? So Peter Vincent kicks Charlie out because Charlie asked too many questions. Charlie goes back home. That's when and Amy and his mom are waiting for him. Colin Farrell tries to get in, saying that he's been bothering him. The mom says, screw you, and he blows up their house.
Right. He's just full on not screwing around. I'm going to blow up your gas line. That's right. I'm sorry. I got carried away. And that's when mom, and so now we've indoctrinated mom at somewhere between minute, what do you think, 50-ish and 55. There's still plenty of time. And now mom knows. And now mom's on her side.
Yep. And I have a question. So they escape the house in a minivan, and Jerry throws a dirt bike at them. He throws that thing 200 yards.
Oh, that's a throw. That was like Achilles making the impossible throw when he threw the spear at the man at the temple.
How heavy is a dirt bike?
I don't know, 300 pounds, 180 pounds, 300 pounds.
So it's heavy. Throw that 200 yards.
Jerry, I think he hooked it. I think,
he could bust through a house. Jerry could.
It's quite a throw. He's like the juggernaut.
And then he catches up. They run over him. And guess who Jerry kills?
Poor Chris Sarandon. poor Chris Sarandon is going to get out of the car and be the random guy who's like, oh my gosh, you guys just ran to me. They're like, no, get back in the car. They ran over this monster.
And then what'd you think of after he got stabbed by that wooden stake, its reaction? It became very monster primally.
Yeah, like it was very twitchy. It was, I'm not saying this because it was like copying it, but it was like a high speed Grudge ghost almost. That weird twitchy arthropod like movement pattern. Like, but that was neat. It's like, again, this is one of those things that bothered me when I first saw it, and I kind of like it now. It's so weird how that goes. But no, that was neat. It showed that monstrous mentality, maybe almost like when Bruce Banner becomes the Hulk, he's not fully himself.
Yeah. That's interesting. It didn't seem himself. It seemed very animalistic.
Well, and it seemed uncontrolled too, because he was right. He was making sounds like, rah, 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 rah. It was like a convulsing animal.
He was like a 30 Days of Night vampire on acid.
But of course, it did just miss the heart. Maybe part of that frantic reaction was the grazing of the heart.
Oh, yeah, it was close.
Right. Yeah. And also when we see its monster now at this point, also when he was walking up to Chris Sarandon, we saw the bigger face. He got the bigger head, the big kind of bobble head, like a Funko Pop.
Oh, yeah.
This is my biggest contention with the movie, by the way, is what they did with that CGI Funko Pop head. I don't like it.
I didn't really care for much of the CGI in this movie, but I guess I just liked the characters in the story, so I didn't mind
it. Yeah, the CGI in general in this film, yeah, wasn't very awesome for me, but I like the things that are happening, and that was a cool scene too. Where they hit him, they drag him along. It seemed a little silly to me, but they're dragging his body along when they're leaving the scene. And then he's like tearing through the bottom of the vehicle.
He's like, that's nasty vampire hand. I told you. And then they get to Peter Vincent's house. That poor lady gets killed. And Evil Ed gets his arm chopped off from a panic room closing.
So Evil Ed was kind of fun here. He was a little too mouthy for me, but I still liked it a lot. Yeah. I liked the way the scene went down with the axe and the Morning Star and everything, but I was really disappointed that there was not any scintilla of effort to go with that wolf form.
Oh, yeah. I guess, yeah. I did like the final line, though, when he's looking at Brewster and he's just like, fuck you, Brewster.
Right.
He's just like, we used to be friends. You showed up late at night. I got turned into a vampire. Now you kill me. Like, get out. Like, I thought that, like, maybe I'm putting too much pathos into that, but I would have loved to have seen a sweet transformation, but that line was, I guess it made up for it a little bit for me. And I have a question. It would have been cool to do. How could they have done a werewolf differently since they were really into doing this differently? Because Jerry doesn't really take over many forms in this movie.
Well, I mean, werewolves take different forms in just about everything. There was an interesting wolfish form in Bram Stoker's Dracula. There was an interesting wolf's form in Fright Night 2. There was an interesting wolf's form in, well, not all, but a lot of different werewolf movies take different approaches to it. I feel like the limiting factor wasn't creativity, but money to pump into the CGI.
Yeah. I mean, this was like a $30 million movie, maybe less. So it was not expensive.
Is that it?
Yeah, it wasn't expensive.
Okay. That CGI must have been very little of it with that cast.
Yeah, they probably definitely did put the money into the cast for this.
But I mean, yeah, I don't think it was lack of ideas. I think it was lack of willingness to do something so different CGI-wise. And also, when you do that, you're doing more than just the head.
Yeah.
You're doing a lot and all those hairs. You've gone off about, you know, how brave every hair, this, that, and the other. And I don't think they're going to brave it. But with the CGI, but at the same time, there's just so much more to do.
Yeah.
With that.
That's a long process.
So, you know, again, disappointed, not upset. I just would have loved to see that. Maybe they also got to rely defense wise on the fact that too many people would be like, there's a werewolf in this.
Yeah.
Whereas back in the day when there weren't as many movies out there stacked up in the world, not that there weren't plenty of werewolf movies then, but, you know, I think that back then people wouldn't have made as much of a connection to the fact that that was from Bram Stoker's story. And nowadays I think that people think of there are werewolves and there are vampires.
Yeah, that's a good point. You're right.
So I'll afford them that defense. I just still wish it was there.
Gotcha. And then what do you think about, I like how Amy throws the water in Jerry's face, but Jerry just walked up to that. Like, if John, if you're breaking cabinets, right? And I'm a vampire, I'm like, I'm pretty sure what's in these cabinets could hurt me. I wouldn't saunter up to you and give you time to douse me with water.
In the honor of 1985, we're just going to look past some stuff.
Yeah, that gave him time to get out of there. And then so they get in a nightclub, and there were good nightclubs. So he gets water in his face, and then Amy and Charlie escape into a nightclub. And there were good dancers, and the extras aren't terrible in this movie. I kind of compared the dancing of both. But it kind of does the whole trope of they can't hold on to each other in a club because they get their arms separated. And then she gets picked up. Jerry bites her. She's like, oh, yeah. Calm
in all fairness, there are a couple teenagers who presumably have never been in a club if they're abiding by the law. And they have no idea of the social and physical dynamic of a club.
There we go. I'm sold.
I would buy that. Yeah. But when I watch it, I feel the tropiness that you're discussing right now.
And then, but I like what you said. That's good. I was feeling a little nitpicky, but yeah, you add some creativity to it, and I like that.
It's, yeah, they don't even know what it's like. It's, just to back up a tiny bit, if I may.
Yeah.
Okay. So when Jerry was visited by Charlie when Peter Vincent was visited by Charlie, and we reached the point where Peter Vincent realizes that Charlie's really dealing with a vampire when he showed him that sign, and he expressed the this, that, and the other of this species of vampire, he actually brought up that he was the only surviving member of his family when he last encountered this kind of vampire.
And it was Jerry.
That's what I'm left to wonder is, was that Jerry, and Or are they making a very loose reference, regardless of actual, you know, time passed in the world, that the Charlie Brewster we saw in the 1985 movie wasn't this Peter Vincent in this movie?
Oh.
So let's just take the 1985 movie.
But however, before we do this, there is a scene later on in the house where Jerry, David Tennant, shooting a shotgun at Jerry. Or when Peter Vincent's shooting a shotgun at Jerry, and Jerry goes, "You have your dad's aim."
Oh, your dad's aim. So yeah. this is Charlie this is 1985. What if, okay, so bear with me.
No, but he didn't have a dad, though.
No, 1985.
Uh-huh.
Ended with the laughing of presumably Evil Ed.
Okay.
Okay. We killed Jerry. No, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. Never mind.
Because of the dad.
Because I wanted to make it such that, well, what if David Tennant's Peter Vincent was 1985 Charlie Brewster's son?
Oh, wait.
In other words, what if after the end of the 1985 movie, Evil Ed had come and taken out eventually Amy and Charlie after they had a child?
But then that means David Tennant would be 85, not like would only be when this movie was filmed under 30. He had some city miles on him, I guess we could say.
Like I said earlier, real time aside. I gave a disclaimer, but again, and that makes it more Evil Ed doing it. But Evil Ed didn't have anything going for him in his life.
Yeah.
What if Evil Ed became Jerry? What if Evil Ed became the next Jerry? What if Evil Ed then hunted down Charlie and Amy? Because I always felt, even when I first saw this film, like, this has to be referencing the original film, which isn't true. It doesn't have to be. But I guess I wanted it to be, right? I wanted it to. And so I looked at that as a weird way to connect the films. Like, what if that Evil Ed that had nothing going for him assumed the life of Jerry and called himself Jerry, hunted down Charlie. Charlie has a kid. Charlie's kid hears this person introduced as Jerry, and now here he is 35 years later. Well, less than 30, like 26 years later. Well, as of the first movie, and then they had to get married and be engaged, get married, have a kid. So really, David Tennant would probably only be a 20-year-old. But I like my storyline, Mark.
Stick with it. Write a post.
I like my storyline.
Shut up. Wait, what? Hey, do you think Jerry 1985 brand of vampire is older than Jerry 2011's brand of vampire? Do you think one's like super ancient and then the other one's more of like a nobility kind of type vampire?
So I have trouble. I know I was thinking about this myself. And so 1985 Jerry is, despite the stupid decision making that he had in that movie, I think that he is a smarter, more thoughtful, more cautious, more humanistic vampire, right? And I think that is that painting that he had was at least Victorian. So at first you want to say that he's probably the older one, but our new Jerry, when they describe the animalistic this, that, and the other, I'm left with two thoughts. One, if he's more animalistic, brutal, this, that, and the other, maybe he's less sophisticated. Maybe he gets by other means. Maybe he's 1,000 years old. Or maybe that species is more reckless, but because they brood so many offspring, the lineage survives. So my answer is I don't have an answer, but I was curious about that too when they brought up the notion of these different species.
Got it. And what'd you think?
What about you?
I think definitely Jerry's more ancient. They're more like more less advanced. They were like.
You think that 2011 Jerry is an older vampire or an older species?
Older,
or both?
I think older species.
Okay.
Feels right. Just the monstrous way it acted.
He's the more civilized version of the Descent.
Oh. I like it.
They had a lot of underground innumerable entities.
Oh, dude, I love The Descent.
What if the Descent took place over Charlie Brewster's house? In the future.
God, let's do it. That'd be horrible. He's like, I can't catch a break.
Poor guy.
All right. So at the end, it's Amy gets taken. Charlie gets dressed up with all this gear. And I love the idea when he's like, well, if you catch a vampire, when you get a vampire on fire and then stake it in the heart, you know, you can kill it. He's like, well, how am I going to get close to a vampire when it's on fire? But so it's Anton Yelchin. He goes to his house, knocks all the windows. He's joined by Peter Vincent, and it's followed by the greatest pebble throw of recent stone history.
But I like that it was prefaced by a Rambo gear loading.
Yeah. Just like him loading up, montage of him buying everything. I like that he bashed all the windows.
And Amy was turned.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, Amy's turned. She gets the white dress, and that leads to, I don't know, I thought that was pretty smart what he did, though. Bashed all the windows, worked his way through methodically, and then David Tennant got a pebble hitting him, and then it turns out that I think Dre was the one who killed his parents. But, well, I don't know, I guess the ending was, what'd you think about the very ending where they blew out the windows and it was all kind of a bunch of vampires?
Okay, well, so many things, Mark.
Yeah.
So, I think so many things, but I want to rewind back to the opening shot of this film.
Uh-oh.
Opening shot of this film showed a disjunct housing development. And the first thing I thought of was Poltergeist. No joke. First time I saw the movie to the most recent time I saw the movie, every time it keeps popping in my head, Poltergeist, because Poltergeist took place like out in Arizona or so, in this little housing, you know, this little growing suburb area where there's no suburbs or businesses adjacent to the housing development. It's remote, right? It's at the outskirts of town. Then you've got Jerry, and we find out that in his basement, he has this grave soil brood of a couple dozen vampire spawn. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay. And then I'm reminded, of Poltergeist. The big thing of Poltergeist. You bulldozed all the tombstones, but you never moved the bodies.
Oh, so you think the bodies were there?
Well, I don't. Oh. But it just strikes me that Jerry did move the bodies. But by the way, how did he move all those bodies?
I have no idea. That's a lot of work.
Right? Because they were all full-fledged vampires, and he was only there for, like, I don't know, a week, 2 weeks. And there were, like, one or two dozen vampires. Maybe he works fast. But again, it's like I was reminded a couple times over of Poltergeist with this little notion, just the setting. That was kind of interesting that of all things popped in my head. I wonder if that influence was there. But so, like you were saying, he throws the pebble, and it for some reason pierces blood in David Tennant's forehead. And then these things start coming out of the walls, like 28 days later zombies, like just raging at him, and with some grudge ghost walking over the ring, walking over the shoulder.
Yep. Yep.
With the leg, with the contortionist. And so I didn't care for any of that, and that's fine. And there's the Imogen Poots thing, and I didn't like the CGI of her mouth, but it was fine. And then Jerry looked like, he looked like the way that Dracula looked when he turned monstrous at the end of Van Helsing.
Oof. Yeah.
When he was burning up, he looked like that weird gargoyle monster. So I feel like a lot of things kind of got out of hand in this scene. And not to belittle the third act of this movie, but this was my least favorite scene, even though it's where all this action was. But it didn't hurt my enjoyment of the movie. It was still fun to watch.
Yeah, none of it bothered me, but I didn't really care about any of it. I love the pebble throw. I like learning about Tennant's parents being killed. I like the idea of him light himself on fire, then attaching himself to Jerry. Like, that's when he clipped himself to Jerry, an on fire Jerry, I was like, that makes sense.
Okay, but if Jerry can throw a motorcycle 200 yards, he'd be able to throw Anton so hard that it would break the clip and or break Anton's back.
He was on fire.
Wouldn't
but
matter.
As we've established on this podcast, between Rogue One, Cure for Wellness, and now Fright Night, backs don't break in movies.
That's true, they don't. But he'd throw him so hard he would die from the impact.
As...
Okay, you know, it's... No, I know, you're... Point taken, Mark. Point taken. And maybe he was weakened by the fire.
You know what's funny, though? All these moments in this movie, I never thought about any of that. Like, it's good when... you know, there's some movies you watch and something stupid happens. You're like, that's stupid. But then you watch other movies and you just don't care.
When Anton Yelchin clipped himself to a vampire while he was on fire, I said, that's stupid.
Really? Oh, I was like, I get it.
No,
like, it can be stupid, but as long as I get it, as long as I'm like, oh, okay, this is what A led to B. And there's a line before it. I'm down.
It's okay. I forgave it. And I even ultimately, not the first time I saw the movie, but ultimately I forgave that horrible CGI shark mouth they gave to Imogen Poots.
I don't even remember it. You know, I never knew how iconic it was. So if I knew how iconic it was and I saw it, I would have grumbled.
True.
But I didn't really know. So I didn't really think too much about it. It should have been like, but see, the thing is, maybe they knew they couldn't be as iconic and it would just be fan service, so they just kind of threw it to the side.
See, I'm surprised they did it at all.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, why even do it? Why not come up with something else interesting?
If you know you're phoning in your CGI, why do it at all?
Yeah,
but maybe at the same time, they felt the pressure of, we have to do it. This was the movie poster image of Fright Night. We have to do it. So I guess I get it.
I think the poster of this one was Colin Farrell looking swarthy on the poster.
The one I have is Anton Yelchin with an axe.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I have to look at my Blu-ray again.
Like on the street of his little neighborhood.
I was going to pull up my Blu-rays that are next to me, but you're not going to believe it. I was on a conference call one day, and instead of listening to it, I organized all my Blu-rays according to like blue covers, white covers, black covers. So they're not
by cover color.
Yeah. So now they're not in alphabetical order anymore. I can't find anything. But yeah, that's a long story. So Fright Night. We got a few more questions. You want to answer those in just a little bit?
Sure.
All right. We got three questions.
So Brett from Clearwater, Florida is coming to us with three more questions continued from our first part of the Fright Night pod series. And he asks, how could have the 2011 version been better? Cast, story, effects? I find this question interesting because it sounds to me like he feels very much, especially how I felt after the first time I saw the movie, that he disfavored it. It was my suspicion.
I mean, there is some wonky CGI, but I like the performances. Maybe you could have ditched the Franco making fun of Frappuccinos and worrying about being cool. And ditch those scenes of him worrying about being cool with more of like him just having more time with Amy. And also I would have liked it if Evil Ed was around for a little while longer, because I thought it was a pretty tragic character for him. So maybe that's what I would have done.
Yeah, so I mean the cast, I have no complaints, right? Just like the original, whole cast was very strong to me. Story, it's... has just as many Swiss cheese holes as the first one, so no criticism.
That's Gouda.
Right. but for me, it's the effects. All the money went into the cast, and it seems like, well, I'm not going to say none, but it seems like relatively little, by my point of view, went into the effects. Now, if you were to increase the effects, would you lose some of these actors? Would that have hurt the movie? I'm sure that would have been the case. But if I could magically just up the degree of the effects or get some practical angles or just better CGI, not that I'm a fan of CGI, but still, or just better CGI. But for me, it's all effects with this movie. Happy with the cast. Story isn't perfect, but neither was the original. You know, I'm willing to say that now that I've seen the remake three or four times. I've come to grips with the fact the original is not a perfect movie either. So yeah, just effects for me. And also to Brett, I'm going to say what I revealed about myself here is, how many times have you seen the remake? And I have a feeling the answer is going to be once. And if the answer is once, and I know he saw the original before their remake, I understand your apprehension. Give it another shot. It'll never be 85 again, but it's worthy. And it's fun.
And I think it does enough to make it stand on its own.
Well, so, you know, part of my apprehension was that accidental purism where, oh, this is so different from the original. This is not even hardly a remake. They just changed all this stuff. Whereas now I look back and I'm kind of appreciative of all the things that they changed, because I don't want to see a 30-year later carbon copy.
Yeah, that you fall asleep during.
Like the Poltergeist remake.
Oh, goodness. Horrible.
Sorry, Poltergeist remake.
No, I'm not sorry.
I guess you're right. No, I'm not. Okay, well, Brett has another for us. Brett asks, so comparing these films, this is going to bleed into the answers from our previous question, but comparing these films, do you miss the older effects and makeup from 85 or enjoy the CGI more?
I love the – I didn't miss anything. All that makeup was so insane back in 85 and so inspired. You can't catch that twice in lightning. You can't catch it twice. You can't do it twice. So I just – I don't know. I guess the first time I saw it was a CGI. I didn't think it was that great. I mean, I love the practical effects more. Are you kidding me? But I didn't miss the older effects at all. And I was wondering if Colin Farrell would actually sit in a chair for 8 hours to have those applied to him.
That's true. He might not. he very, especially not if they're going to turn him into a gargoyle monster.
Yeah, he's not going to mess with that. Just make his face CGI and call it a day.
Yeah, you know, it's like, well, I'm not saying I was looking for the same effects, but I do like practical effects, and they do practically take a really long time. But yeah, no, I missed 1985. I missed it a lot. I've seen a lot of movies with CGI that looked decent or even cool, but those I feel like are my minority for horror.
Yeah.
And so as a result, I find myself erring on the side of I'm willing to take weaker performances a lot of the time, for the sake of the effects. But then again, I wouldn't have wanted to sacrifice a Colin Farrell or a Toni Collette or an Imogen Poots. Right, I wouldn't want to, or Anton Yelchin, I wouldn't have wanted to lose any of them, or something Mintz, what's the guy's name?
Oh, Christopher Mintz-Plasse.
Yes, or him. Now that I've seen it with them, I wouldn't have wanted to sacrifice them. I get this is post hoc, but I wouldn't want to sacrifice them. I'm catch-22'd. Before I see a movie, I'd say, give me the effects and the heart, and then whatever has to happen with the actors afterwards, give it to me. But now that I've seen those actors, I'm like, okay, I don't want to lose any of them.
Yeah, it's weird, right? I'm at peace with both movies.
Well, again, if he had asked me this question in 2010, before this remake came out, and before I knew what the cast would be, I'd be like, oh yes, no, just yeah, effects. But now that I've seen it, I don't have that unbiased approach. And it's like, no, I like them. I don't want to lose any of them. And the worst part is, what if you lost only one of those actors for those effects? And then you had one weak performance amid a bunch of other strong performances. Sometimes that spoils the rest of the batch.
Yeah, because you couldn't have had a stock mom or a stock girlfriend.
Yeah, if the mom had the same level of role and you didn't get Toni Collette and you got someone who I don't know, that could have been tragic.
Yep. Yep.
Or not detrimental.
There we go.
Either way. That's a tough one. So Brett comes in with one more. I really like this question. If they were to remake Fright Night, who would be your choice in cast and how would you change the story?
All right. So we've had one Fright Night. Sorry to jump on. Do you want to answer this first?
Mm-mm.
Okay. So we have one Fright Night already with a dude and then another dude. Then we have another Fright Night with a dude and another dude. I would love it if, let's say, Haley Steinfeld from Pitch Perfect 3, right? She's home from college for a summer. Next door, Aubrey Plaza and Anna Kendrick move in. Aubrey Plaza's the vampire. She's awesome in Legion, by the way. And Anna Kendrick is her Billy Cole. And then she starts seeing them, you know, killing. Do they bring over, you know, gigolos? Like, is Richard Gere coming over? I don't know. They start bringing people over, you know, with dating apps. I don't know, whatever. I wouldn't want it dated.
Oh, totally. With the dating apps, yeah. Makes it easy. Yeah.
And then they start doing that. She thinks something's up. You know, they get on to her. She goes after like a Peter Vincent type. I haven't even thought that far about who that would be, but she gets that. And then it's kind of like the same thing out. Maybe it's her and her dad that live together and the girls like threaten the father. And it's just like an inverse or, you know, like a 180 of what has happened before. Because I think you could have fun with that. After watching Aubrey Plaza in Legion, she's been awesome. And she's been, like, scary. She's been comedic. She could pull that off. Andrew Kendrick could just be a funny little Billy Cole, just being a bully.
Who was Aubrey Plaza?
She's, like, in Parks and Rec, Safety Not Guaranteed. Have you seen that new commercial where she's with the phone? And she,
wait,
like...
wait. In Parks and Rec, was she Chris Pratt's wife?
Yep.
Okay, all right, now I'm with you.
And she's in, if you watch Legion, you'll totally get what I'm saying. And she's in Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates, because she's already in.
Right.
I just like the idea of that. Flip it around, have some fun with it. You know, as opposed to like a son-mother, father-daughter relationship, the father's like supportive. I don't know who the Peter Vincent would be. I don't think you have to make it like, you know, bring David Tennant back. I don't give a shit, I love him. You know, add something like that, you know, that where they gotta... you know, research these people. They're more tech savvy now. It's just, if you think about it, 2011 to 2018, there's still a lot of differences in technology between those times. So just make it, have some fun with it, make it R-rated, keep it scary. You know, shoot, I'm sure Aubrey Plaza will be down for some practical effects. Just have more fun with it. I think that would make a pretty cool remake.
So my take is to almost do a modern carbon copy of the original, because I love it too much. But go really out there with the actors. I'm pretending that we have a serious budget for the actors. And for me, so recently I've been watching 13 Reasons Why Season 2. So my young cast is all from that. When I think of Charlie, I think of Dylan Minnette, who plays Cole in 13 Reasons Why Seasons 1 and 2. For my Amy, I've got Catherine Langford, who plays Hannah, the girl who's passed already in seasons 1 and 2 of 13 Reasons Why. And for Ed, I think of Miles Heiser, who plays the guy who in that show commits suicide at the end of season 1, but it turns out he failed and he's still alive in season 2. He's my Heath Ledger wild card. So all three of these actors are going drop dead serious. Right. These are all serious, very talented young actors. But now I'm totally reversing it. All of my adult characters are bringing the entirety of the comedy. There's no more of this Amy Charlie stuff being funny. So the mom, I'm thinking either Kate McKinnon or Kristen Wiig.
That's going for it.
Right. Right. OK. All right. Jerry, you're not going to be shocked at all. Either Zac Efron or Ryan Reynolds.
Oh, brother.
Charming, very sharp, very chic, very improv-centric for on-screen stuff. So I think that they'd work well with my either Kate McKinnon or Kristen Wiig. And for Billy, now I'm going a little more serious. Either Dane DeHaan, Billy Cole, that is. Dane DeHaan, maybe a Miles Teller. Or even a Jonah Hill.
Interesting.
I think the Jonah Hill would work better for a Zac Efron, and a Miles Teller or a Dane DeHaan would work better for a Ryan Reynolds.
I'd like a Kristen Wiig more than Kate McKinnon.
I'm in love with both of these women, so I can't help myself.
Kate McKinnon, whenever she acts, it's just always a bit. Like, I never feel like there's a real person there.
Maybe this would open her up.
There we go.
But these are... Now, for Peter Vincent, though, this is one of those things where, like, I wasn't willing to touch it. I had, like, 89 ideas, and none of them really felt right. I found myself thinking of everything from Robin Williams to Willem Dafoe, like all these highly idiosyncratic actors, to Ryan Reynolds himself instead of a Jerry character. I could not find any peace.
I would do Simon Pegg.
Oh, that. Oh, I really like that idea.
I'm adding Simon Pegg to my movie.
I really like that idea, actually.
He's a nerd guy. You could buy it.
I could see Simon Pegg also being a Billy.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. What's the other fellow's name? Nick something?
Nick Frost.
He could... What if he was the Billy?
Nick Frost was Billy?
And what if Simon Pegg... Oh, he can't be a Jerry, though. He's no Jerry.
He could be Peter Vincent.
He could be the Peter Vincent, but I'd love to see the two of them. Yeah, that'd be fun. Boy, you could get the whole cast of like a movie like Grabbers. The cast like that would be great for a movie like this in my head.
Oh, yeah, those guys are good. All of them are good. I like Grabbers.
Yeah, but when it came to Peter Vincent in general, I collapsed. I couldn't really hone in. That's such a in-the-moment decision.
Roddy crushed it.
He did. He did, and so did David Tennant.
Oh, I would love me some DT, some day 10.
Yeah, I don't know what else I'd do, but I really like my 13 Reasons Why cast for like a very serious straight guy set of roles where the kids are all serious and all the humor is coming from your antagonist and the mother.
That Manette was on that movie Goosebumps that I worked on. I like that.
Oh,
movie.
Yeah?
Yeah. He's good in that movie.
I haven't seen that one.
It's good. He and his mom have a good, Amy Ryan should play the mom. They had a really great relationship in that movie. Throw Jack Black in. Throw in the cast of Goosebumps.
Jack Black is a Peter Vincent.
Yeah, he'd be great.
Oh, that, yeah.
Associate producer.
Boom. Rich in no time.
Any closing thoughts or plugs?
Closing thoughts. For me, this will never be 1985's Fright Night, but it has now earned a very worthy place in my heart as a really fun movie to watch any old time that you stumbled across, anyone who hasn't seen it yet. This is becoming a good, not back burner in a bad way, but a good back burner movie for me.
Well, I think that's a very good point. It's a good back burner movie. Put it on while you clean the house.
Yeah, like
there's nothing wrong with that.
But plugs, lots of plugs, lots of great people supporting us. All these people are on Twitter. So I'm just going to read off their handles and tell you where to find them. There's Leo Craven. He's at leocraven.com. He's a fiction and horror writer. He's all over our material, staunch supporter. By Horror from byhorror.com. We've got Mr. Horror at horrormoviesandstuff.com. John F. Leonard at johnfleonard.com. Everyone's just going with names, it seems. John F. Leonard. And Leo Craven, they're both horror writers or fiction writers. We've got Grim Horror, Isaac Horror from isaachorror.com. Some of his stuff has become film in the last year. Johnny Numb from Crash Palace Productions and the Last Knock podcast. Good friends of the pod. He also writes for Loud Green Bird. And of course, Billy Crash from Crash Palace. They give us lots of shout outs. I recently enjoyed their sewer horror episode where they were suggesting that at one point they might need an entomologist to talk about bugs and horror. And they were giving me a nice nod. But I enjoy a lot of these guys' material, and they're staunch supporters of ours. And so thank you to all those folks.
Were they talking about Mimic?
You know, they mentioned that in passing dismissively. That is not a favorite of theirs. They just meant bugs and horror in general, I think.
Got it.
But yeah, Mark, do you have any extra plugs? Do you have any closing thoughts? Do you want to let them know what we're doing next week?
Yeah, we're going to be covering The Happening, so please send in questions. Also, head to moviesfilmsandflicks.com, F-L-I-X.com. Check out all the stuff we've written, John's Horror Corner. Check out his index. Check out all of our data, my MFF data. Also, head to iTunes and rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast. We'd love to know what you think. And, once again, thank you for listening. Thank you for listening to this doubleheader. If you haven't watched, if you've watched the remake of Fright Night, go back and watch the original Fright Night. Listen to that podcast. Go listen to our two-part CB's podcast. And thank you so much for listening. So for me, Mark Hoffmeyer, and for John Levengood, this is Movies, Films, and Flicks. Good night.